This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM in good old Bloomington Normal, 89.5 FM in McLean County, I should say, and 92.5 FM in Bloomington Normal, 88.3 FM in Pontiac, and 97.1 FM in Lincoln. And we broadcast up and down the good old double nickel, that's Interstate 55, all the way from south of Lincoln up to north of Pontiac. So it's a long, long strip in there, 100 miles. We've got a lot of listeners out there. If there's anybody out there who would like to be a sponsor of Catholic Spirit Radio, contact our website. That's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. And you can be a sponsor and be heard all over McLean County and some of the surrounding counties and up and down the double nickel for about 100 miles. Check with us. And if you would like to make a donation, it is the donors who pay our bills, and we're being brought to you by you. So any donation that anyone can make, we would very much appreciate. Again, go to CatholicSpiritRadio.com. That's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. And that's our website, and it will tell you how to make a donation. It will also give you a lot of information about us and what we do, and be a very interesting place to go. So for those people listening out there, be sure to check that out. I'm here today by myself again without my wife, Lynn. And as you know from last week, Lynn did have an operation on her shoulder. Everything went perfectly fine, but she is home today working with her daughter, came over to help with a lot of things with the house and so forth. To do for her, so she decided to stay home and probably supervise and direct her daughter to her daughter's probably great joy. So at any rate, I'm here by myself. We're going to have a great show for you today, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Shakespeare. Last week we talked about just condensed Shakespeare, you know, his life a little bit and times, and we read from the book Literature, What Every Catholic Should Know by Joseph Pierce. And he gave a very short synopsis of Shakespeare. And I mentioned that he has also written a book, The Quest for Shakespeare, showing that Shakespeare really was a Catholic. There is so much overwhelming evidence today accumulated piece by piece. A lot of it circumstantial, but so much of it that there really, in my mind at least, and in many, many people's mind, there is no doubt that William Shakespeare was a Catholic. And I want to read from his book today, The Quest for Shakespeare, The Bard of Avon and the Church of Rome, again by Joseph Pierce, is put out by Ignatius Press. If you'd like to get it, I'm sure you can get it through the Dwelling Place, and that's over on College Avenue, just west of the Kroger store on the north side there, same side of the street as the Kroger store. There's a little strip mall in there, and you can stop there, and he would have it. You can probably also order it online, or you can probably get it at one of the bookstores in town. So at any Barnes & Noble would be a good place also. They could probably order it. But if you'll stop at the Dwelling Place, I'm sure Bob over there either has a copy. If he doesn't have it, he can order it for you. There's no shipping charge that way. So be sure to check that out. It's a great book. It's really interesting. I just want to mention, if there are any young people out there, especially young people, potential Shakespeare scholars that are interested, it would be something you could do, look into it even further. There's a lot of work being done and on the fact that Shakespeare was a Catholic. And I want today to use some excerpts from the book to show not only that Shakespeare was a Catholic, but also just to show how England treated Catholics during Shakespeare's time. From that time, from the Reformation, the English Reformation, Henry VIII, I think it was probably about 1534, right in there. For about 250 years, Catholics were severely persecuted. First of all, during Shakespeare's father's time, and there was a lot of Catholic resistance back at that time, and we'll get into that a little bit. And then as things progressed and things got worse under Elizabeth and also under King James when he took over, the resistance, the Catholic resistance, was actually crushed. And Catholicism really went underground in England, and almost all Catholics were secret Catholics because it was very, very dangerous to be a Catholic, and you could be punished in very severe ways, killed and tortured in severe ways, and we'll get into some of those as we go along. But Shakespeare had to navigate those waters and write his plays and keep his family going, and a lot of the things in Shakespeare's life that have been conjectured about why he did this, that, or the other. Understanding that he was Catholic gives us a whole new explanation and a far more comprehensive understanding of why he behaved the way he did and did what he did. Because if you were a Catholic at that time, like he was, you had to be very, very careful about what you did, especially, you know, if you were associating with other Catholics and practicing the faith. You had to walk a very, very fine line, sort of walk a tightrope, so to speak. And Shakespeare was able to do that. So let's go ahead and start from the book, the introduction from the prologue. And Joseph Pierce starts out and he says, Shakespeare is perhaps the greatest writer who ever lived. And he may be. I mean, he's right up there with Dante, and he's right up there with Homer. And if there's anybody as great or greater than him, it would be those two. And in my opinion, probably not. He's at least as good as those. And he wrote on so many different levels. And there is so much in his writing. And at the same time, he was an entertainer. He made a lot of money from his writing at the Globe Theater and came to own property and so forth, and acted in his own plays. They were very popular, and many, many people attended. And he appealed to audiences all the way from the poorest of the poor, the ignorant, the uneducated who couldn't even read and write. And his plays had something for everybody, and yet at the same time, they had a tremendous depth and a tremendous meaning that is still being mined today. He was universal. He was a man for all time, not just for his time. So if you really want to read and study Shakespeare, read the literature, whatever Catholic should know, by Joseph Pierce, and I would also suggest that you read The Quest for Shakespeare by Joseph Pierce. So, well, let's go on. William Shakespeare was born in April 1564 in Stratford-on-Avon in the English country of Warwickshire during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. His family was relatively wealthy, owning a good deal of land in the local area, and his father was, at the time of William's birth, chamberlain, that would be manager, of the Stratford Corporation, sort of like a city manager. It is likely that he was educated, Shakespeare, at the local grammar school, probably beginning in 1571 and ending in 1579 or thereabouts. But actually, Shakespeare's education, he might have gotten more education. Ben Jonson said he had a little Latin and less Greek, but the fact is that Shakespeare was probably as well educated in Latin as most college graduate scholars in Latin are today, and probably as well educated in Greek as well, and understood, you know, the classics, understood Catholic history and Catholicism, and he was very well suited to be able to write the plays he did. Some people have suggested that he wasn't educated enough to write those plays. I can't go into everything in this book, but if you read it, you'll find out that his education was far more comprehensive than what people knew back at the time, shortly after, you know, Shakespeare died. So little is known of Shakespeare's whereabouts from 1579 until his marriage to Anne Hathaway in 1582. And there is more information on that, and also has a lot to do with Catholicism. A lot of fathers, you know, that remained Catholic sent their sons away for an education from where they were, often because of the fact that the persecution going on had a big bearing on that. But at any rate, he married Anne Hathaway in 1582, and it has been conjectured that this was a period in which he served as a tutor to a wealthy Catholic family in the north of England. In northern England was very, very Catholic. And of course, Stratford-on-Avon was very, very Catholic, too, as well. And there were uprisings in northern England against the crown, and eventually these were put down, and like I say, the resistance was eventually crushed. But at first, when Shakespeare was small, there was still open resistance against the new religion, against the Anglican religion that Henry VIII instituted. And then Shakespeare's first child, Susanna, was born in 1583, and his twins, Hamlet and Judith, in 1585, and they would have no further children, and it seems that Shakespeare left Stratford for London soon after the birth of the twins. Shakespeare was gone a lot, back and forth. He lived in London a lot. That's where he did his plays and so forth, But the more information that comes to the surface, the more it's understood that a lot of the fact that Shakespeare left Stratford-on-Avon and left his family for extended periods of time wasn't simply because he was pursuing his own interests. It was also because he often had to move away from areas where, you know, the fact is that he was suspected of being Catholic. His father, of course, was fined and so forth, as we'll see, for being Catholic. And a lot of people had to be on the dodge in Shakespeare's time. And this was one of the things that Shakespeare had to do, because often you would have local enemies and they would dislike you. And if you got out of their sight for a period of time, it would sometimes die down and you could come back and so forth. And so that might have had a lot to do. And it probably estranged Shakespeare from his wife to a certain extent and being gone. And we can see in some of his poems that he wrote, his sonnets, that he wrote about this. And we'll see one in which Shakespeare loved a pun and write on various levels. And we'll see one where the poem is really addressed to his wife and concerning the estrangement because of his being gone a lot. And so we'll see a little bit about that. We hope if we can get to it. It is known, however, that he kept in touch with his family, returning to Stratford regularly, and that he continued to provide financially for their needs. The period between Shakespeare's departure from Stratford-upon-Avon, and again, the town, Stratford-upon-Avon, I mean, you know, Stratford-upon-the-River-Avon, in the mid-1850s until the time he reemerges as a rising playwright in the early 1590s, has become known as the Lost Years, because so little is known of his actions or his whereabouts during this time. Shakespeare spent the last years of his life in his hometown of Stratford, reunited with his wife and family, and he died on St. George's Day in 1616 and is buried in the chancel of the local Holy Trinity Church. So, but that would be an Anglican church, the Holy Trinity Church, I'm sure, probably. But the fact is that as we see along here, he was Catholic and had to live sort of a double life. The quest for the real Shakespeare is akin to a detective story in which the Shakespearean biographer is cast in the role of a literary sleuth pursuing his quarry like a latter-day Sherlock Holmes. And there is still, you know, evidence coming to the surface, and everything will ever be found about Shakespeare's life, simply because if he was a Catholic, and the evidence is overwhelming that he was, he had to do a lot of things in secret, he associated with a lot of people and so forth in secret, and practiced his faith in secret in defiance of the authorities. And we'll see what can happen to you or could happen to you back at that time if you were caught and disobeyed. Throughout the 20th century, a good deal of solid historical detective work was done, adding significantly to the few external and political facts known by some of the Shakespearean scholars, especially Chesterton. In consequence, the claims made by some of the scholars in Shakespeare and the Catholic religion, published almost exactly a century after some of the earlier volumes, were more confidently emphatic. And quote here, when many of the extant pieces of the puzzle of Shakespeare's life are assembled, it is very difficult to deny his Catholicism. Even as the solid work of historians bring the real Shakespeare to life, the volumes of literary criticism continue to pick over the bones of the corpse of their unreal Shakespearean chimera. The long-suffering son of Stratford is being picked apart by historicists, feminists, Marxists, new historicists, post-feminists, deconstructionists, anti-deconstructionists, post-modernists, cultural imperialists, and post-colonialists. And we live in an age when that is happening. We have groups upon groups upon groups of protesters and people for this and for that, and all of them, it seems, try to make Shakespeare one of their own. And he's torn into pieces by all of these conjectures, and most of it is simply grandiose wishful thinking on the part of people who want Shakespeare to represent them, all the way from homosexuality to just about every ism and philosophy that you can think of. Because of his great fame, they would love to have Shakespeare be the precedent for what they happen to believe in. And the fact is that is not true. He certainly wasn't all of those things. The facts are that he was a practicing Catholic and traditionalist and a family man, and not any of those things that the people suggest that he is, because they want to use him as their champion. So anyhow, this is where we will leave all of these critics arguing amongst themselves while we begin to look at the real William Shakespeare. Though Shakespeare is real, he is also elusive, defying our efforts to define him. Try as we might to pin him down, he always seems to get away. We don't even know for certain what he looked like. The various paintings claiming to be portraits of him are most probably of someone else. The painting that seems to have the greatest claim to authenticity, the famous Chandos portrait, looks at us with the enigmatic suggestiveness of the Mona Lisa. As with Leonardo's famous portrait, the Chandos Shakespeare seduces us with its aura of mystery, its unanswered question. Who is this man who looks at us knowingly from the canvas? What secrets does he conceal? So you probably know that particular picture of Shakespeare. You've probably seen it everywhere. It's taken to be him. But the fact is that if you read this book and you come to understand more about what went on in Shakespeare's life, you'll realize it's probably not him at all. Shakespeare was very secretive, and so that enigmatic man, though, can certainly represent the real Shakespeare in the sense that we look at that picture and it does have that mysterious look. It looks out at us with this sort of a knowing half-smile look, sort of like the Mona Lisa, like it says here in the book, and you wonder, who was he really? This seems to have been the question on Matthew Arnold's mind when he composed his sonnet about Shakespeare. And as the conclusion of the sonnet testifies, he composed, testifies, the great Victorian believed that the identity of his elusive Elizabethan forebear was not particularly important. In other words, he's saying Matthew Arnold, a 19th century person, believed that Shakespeare's identity was not that important because, he says, "And thou, who didst the stars and sunbeams know, self-schooled, self-scanned, self-honored, self-secure, didst walk on earth unguessed at. Better so. All pains the immortal spirit must endure, all weakness that impairs, all griefs that bow, find their sole voice in that victorious brow." He's talking about Shakespeare. But at any rate, there was a man behind that mask, and we're going to try to find out a little bit about him. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Blessed are those who have been persecuted for righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Matthew chapter 5. It's not easy being a Christian today. This is a time of great persecution. In some parts of the world, religious freedoms and the freedom of speech are being twisted and taken away. In other places, churches are being burned. Meanwhile, wars and killings are targeting Christians more and more. Evil will not win out. The church has been persecuted before. Our part is to rejoice in our faith, be Christ-like, confident of the great reward ahead of us. This has been Michael Gisondi with a bit of Catholic encouragement.
Here are some of our listeners' favorite programs on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Mother Angelica.
I enjoy listening to Al Cresta.
I listen to Women of Grace, Call of Communion, Catholic Answers.
Praying the Rosary and the Divine Mercy Chaplet.
The Sunrise Morning Show.
I like sports on Blessed to Play and the Bear Wozniak Adventure.
I enjoy the program Catholic Answers Live.
I like Being Catholic with Bob and Lynn Johnston the best.
Bob, you can't do that. You're the host.
Yeah, but that's why I like it, because I always agree with Bob.
Of course.
All right. Then I like Word on Fire, The Journey Home, and EWTN Open Line.
And I like Take Two and Morning Glory.
Help to continue the excellent programming on this station by donating online at CatholicSpiritRadio.com or sending a donation to 108 Boykins Place in Normal. This radio station is supported solely by the generosity of its listeners.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic. We're back from our break. We're talking about William Shakespeare from the book by Joseph Pierce, The Quest for Shakespeare, The Bard of Avon, and The Church of Rome. We're talking about the fact that Shakespeare was Catholic. We're talking about his secretive life. And I was just quoting from a poem by Matthew Arnold, a 19th century scholar writing about Shakespeare. And Arnold says that we don't really need to know anything about Shakespeare because the man actually shows us ourselves so well, it really doesn't matter that he fails to show us himself. But Pierce says, there is, however, a serious problem with such a conclusion, a problem that is so serious that it amounts to a fatal flaw in the reading of Shakespeare's works and a consequent blindness to the truths that emerge from them. It is this: what if the image of ourselves that we see in the mirror is distorted by our lack of knowledge of the one who holds the mirror? What if our understanding of Shakespeare is essential to our understanding of ourselves as reflected by Shakespeare? What if we misunderstand and misconstrue what he is showing us, if we misunderstand and misconstrue what he means to show us? What if Shakespeare is not simply holding the mirror? What if he is the mirror? What if the plays are, in some mystical or immanent way, an artistic incarnation of the playwright? What if the words only become flesh if we understand the personhood and philosophy of the flesh that gave birth to the words? In some ways, the quest for the real Shakespeare can be likened to the quest for the Holy Grail. Some refuse to join the quest on the basis that the Grail is unimportant. These are the postmoderns and deconstructionists who believe that they are as capable of understanding the plays as was the playwright himself, and that they do not need his help to do so, or else they believe that the plays have no meaning anyway, and that therefore there is nothing to understand. For these hollow men, slaves of the zeitgeist, there is little hope. And remember, we talked about the zeitgeist last time, and it means literally the spirit of the times, as opposed to the Holy Geist, which is the Holy Spirit of all times. The safest and most likely conclusion, wrote Peter Ackroyd in his Life of the Bard, must be that despite his manifold Catholic connections, Shakespeare professed no particular faith. Just as he was a man without opinions, so was he a man without belief, you know, according to Ackroyd. And Pierce answers, one cannot resist a riposte to such errant nonsense. The fact is that there is no such thing as a man without opinions or a man without beliefs. Indeed, a man without beliefs is simply beyond belief. Agnosticism is a belief. Atheism is a belief. Nihilism is a belief. And these beliefs obviously inform our opinions. And people who go around and say that they don't believe in anything usually end up believing in everything. Against this profane interpretation of Shakespeare's works, there is a long tradition of belief that Shakespeare's plays betray an element of Catholicism. Thomas Carlyle wrote that the Elizabethan era, with its Shakespeare as the outcome and flowerage of all which had preceded it, is itself attributable to the Catholicism of the Middle Ages. John Henry Newman was even more emphatic about the Catholic dimension, stating that Shakespeare has so little of a Protestant about him that Catholics have been able, without extravagance, to claim him as their own. And in 1907, Chesterton had compared the chasm that separated Shakespeare the Catholic from Milton the Protestant. And Chesterton said, whenever Milton speaks of religion, it is Milton's religion, the religion that Milton has made. Whenever Shakespeare speaks of religion, which is only seldom, it is of a religion that has made him. And that is, as Chesterton goes on and shows, a huge difference between Protestantism and Catholicism. Catholicism is the religion that stands the same all the way from the time of Christ till today. And men who are faithful are expected, and when I say men, I mean everybody, are faithful, are expected to conform to it. Protestantism has spawned many individualized religions and is interpreted so much autonomously by individual people, and a lot of times simply to fulfill what they want for themselves. Not surprisingly, perhaps, Chesterton was asked to clarify the rationale behind his assertion of Shakespeare's Catholicism, and here's what he said. He said, "A correspondent has written to me asking me what I meant by saying that Shakespeare was a Catholic and that Milton was a Protestant. That Milton was a Protestant, I suppose, no one will dispute. But the point about the religion of Shakespeare is certainly less obvious, though I think not less true. Milton is possessed with what is, I suppose, the first and finest idea of Protestantism, the idea of the individual soul actually testing and tasting all the truth there is, and calling that truth, which it has not tested or tasted, truth of a less valuable and vivid kind. But Shakespeare is possessed through and through with the feeling which is the first and finest idea of Catholicism, that the truth exists whether we like it or not, and that it is for us to accommodate ourselves to it. But I really do not know how this indescribable matter can better be described than by simply saying this, that Milton's religion was Milton's religion, and that Shakespeare's religion was not Shakespeare's." And that is a really, Chesterton had this fine ability to put his finger on the central issue of things, and that is so true, that the religion, you know, the Catholic religion is not the religion of the believer. It is the Catholic religion, and the believer believes in it. And Protestantism so often is, as Chesterton said, Milton's religion was Milton's religion. His was a particular form of Protestantism suited to Milton. And we find that all through Protestantism. I'm not trying to be nasty here or condemn or, you know, Protestants and many fine people. I'm saying that's a fact. That Protestantism, I mean, you know, it is sort of tailored to fit the particular desires and needs of the group of people or a person or even single person who is the believer. And Catholicism is not that way at all. And Catholicism is far more social in the sense of obedience to authority. Chesterton's comparison of Shakespeare with Milton is intriguing, indicating that, in Chesterton's judgment, the former belonged to the old England of Catholicism, whereas the latter, Milton, belonged to the new England of Protestantism. He is saying that Shakespeare, living during the crucible of religious change, was rooted in the old faith, whereas Milton, as a genuine modern, had embraced post-Catholicism with the implicit relativism of a custom-built or personalized faith, in much the same way as his successors would embrace post-Christianity with the explicit relativism of faithless individualism. And so Pierce is referring here to our own times. And he's saying this is what, you know, happens when you tailor religion to yourself instead of the other way around, in which it was handed on to you, intact and passed on along the line in the same way. In other words, what we have today is sort of a secularized, tailored secularism, this idea that you can believe as an individual and tailor the religion to yourself. The religion gets watered down into pure materialism and becomes secular, and that's what we have today, and becomes this postmodern idea of relativism and sort of faithless individualism, everything based on the material world and nothing else. And a rejection, actually, of material leads to this, as we'll see later on if we can have time to get to it. And you find that in Catholicism, you find this emphasis on the importance of the material, wine and water and all the things. If you look in the Old Testament, you find that too, emphasis on material as being part of the supernatural, you know, material being a link between, you know, God and man. And in Protestantism over time, that because material itself is rejected, it degenerates into a materialism in which this world is one thing and the heavenly world is another thing, and never the twain shall meet. And we find that. We find that even in Judge Scalia, for example, Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court, you know, prior to his death here in the past, not too long, past year or two, he said the same, my job is to take care of the earthly things, and the priest's job is to take care of the heavenly things. And here Scalia is a Catholic, and the fact is that he's falling into that secular idea that there's a separation of heaven and earth, a separation of material and the spiritual. And in the religion of Catholicism itself, traditionally, there is no separation. Much of the material is used spiritually. The Eucharist, for example, and so forth. I can't get into a lot of that now, but there's a huge difference there between, if you look at Shakespeare's plays and how he treated, you know, material and how he looked at things, than there is between, say, Milton, who tailored Satan and tailored the spiritual world to his own particular beliefs. The fact that Shakespeare has much more in common with the medieval past than with the postmodern present has been stressed by modern Shakespeare scholars. Taken to its logical conclusion, this means that all postmodern readings of Shakespeare are inevitably and by definition awry. Take, for example, Shakespeare's condemnation of each of the seven deadly sins: pride, envy, gluttony, avarice, anger, lust, and so on. Shakespeare did not merely condemn each of the seven deadly sins. He ordered them in conformity to the teaching of the Catholic Church. You don't find that in the actual Protestant writers of Shakespeare's time. And he ordered them to conform to the teaching of the Church as reflected in the works of St. Thomas Aquinas, as echoed by Dante in his Thomistic masterpiece, The Divine Comedy. Shakespeare condemns the sin of pride, and he describes lust or unchastity as the least grievous. Of the deadly sins, it is the least. That might be surprising, that lust is the least, you know, deadly of the deadly sins. Nevertheless, Shakespeare treats it as deadly. They're all deadly. And you might want to read this book and find out more about why Shakespeare thinks that or says that. So make sure that you do, if you get a chance, get the book, The Quest for Shakespeare, and read it. And you'll find out this is all fleshed out. We just don't have the time to go into all of it because it's just too much. But it's a great book, and it will really be enjoyable. And for a person that wants to really get involved in being a Shakespeare scholar, it opens up a whole new door and window to a very exciting quest or endeavor. What traces of the Catholic veneration of saints condemned in Elizabethan England are nevertheless to be found in Shakespeare? In other words, Elizabethan England under, you know, the new religion, the Anglican religion, it condemned the veneration of saints, that is, the honoring of saints. In the Catholic Church, we honor the saints. We don't worship them, we honor them and venerate them, is what that means. And this was considered some form of worship in Elizabeth. You can see how fast things change in Elizabethan England. Of course, you know, many traditional Catholics resisted this idea that we were not to venerate the saints. So you can see the growing separation of all of these, the deadly sins and so forth. You can see as this goes along, the Protestant religion start to separate the world into two parts, one that is purely material and the other that is purely spiritual, and never the twain shall meet. The highly significant fact that Shakespeare reveals a very exact and detailed knowledge of Catholicism is quoted by Father Sebastian. People quote this one priest, conclusions that the repeated allusions to Catholic rites and practices are introduced with a delicacy and fitness possible only for a mind habituated to the Church's tone of thought. I mean, Shakespeare not only uses all of these things in his plays, he uses them very finely, with a very fine and delicate understanding of these things, whereas you don't find that in a lot of the other poets, especially if you read Christopher Marlowe, and he was born in the same year as Shakespeare. And Christopher Marlowe was suspected of being very pro-Catholic, but if we understand and read Christopher Marlowe's life, we find so much evidence that more than likely he was a spy for the queen. And that's why he acted as if he were a Catholic, because many of these people did this and learned all about Catholicism and acted like a Catholic and moved among Catholics and became, in effect, you know, a spy among these Catholics, and then gave these people over to the authorities, and some of them, of course, were killed, you know, in horrible ways. We also find Shakespeare's father, he left a will that was Catholic. He says, "Let's begin our investigation in Shakespeare's life by looking at the overwhelming evidence that the faith of his family was Catholic." In 1930, the Shakespearean scholar E.K. Chambers published William Shakespeare, A Study of Facts and Problems, in which he affirmed the genuineness of John Shakespeare's spiritual will in the face of earlier suggestions that had been a forgery. Now, his will was found in much, much later when there was being some repairs done to the roof of Shakespeare's house. And I think this was about 200 years later. And one of the workmen found a will. I mean, it was a spiritual will. It wasn't a regular, you know, family will. And it was, you know, signed by John Shakespeare. And it was written about 1581 or thereabouts. And it was discovered underneath a roof rafter, you know, between the roof of the house and the rafter itself. And the person that found it turned it over to some scholars that understood it more. And it's been pretty much proven that it's real. And it's not a fake, as many, many Protestant scholars have tried to say. It's proper to observe that the finder of this relic bore the character of a very honest, sober, and industrious man, and that he neither asked nor received any price for it. So we're finding a lot of evidence here that, you know, Shakespeare's whole family was Catholic, and so he would have been raised in a very strong Catholic atmosphere. And later we find out that Shakespeare's father, who was on the town council of Stratford, resisted a lot of the ordinances that were passed that had, you know, removing Catholic artifacts and so forth from the churches in Stratford, and eventually was accused of being recusant, that is, being still a Catholic, and he was fined for this. And at some point, he also left the city council and left the city managership for quite some time. And it coincides with some of the more stricter laws that were starting to be passed and even enforced as the Catholic resistance was being overcome. So we're going to stop here. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Here are some of our listeners' favorite programs on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Mother Angelica.
I enjoy listening to Al Cresta.
I listen to Women of Grace, Call of Communion, Catholic Answers.
Praying the Rosary, and the Divine Mercy Chaplet.
The Sunrise Morning Show.
I like sports on Blessed to Play, and the Bear Wozniak Adventure.
I enjoy the program Catholic Answers Live.
I like Being Catholic with Bob and Lynn Johnston the best.
Bob, you can't do that. You're the host.
Yeah, but that's why I like it, because I always agree with Bob.
Of course.
All right. Then I like Word on Fire, The Journey Home, and EWTN Open Line.
And I like Take Two and Morning Glory.
Help to continue the excellent programming on this station by donating online at CatholicSpiritRadio.com or sending a donation to 108 Boykins Place in Normal. This radio station is supported solely by the generosity of its listeners.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. We're back from our break. We're talking about William Shakespeare as being a Catholic and living in very, very just dangerous times in Elizabethan England. And the book that we're quoting from is The Quest for Shakespeare, The Bard of Avon and the Church of Rome by Joseph Pearce. And it's a very interesting and enlightening book. And it teaches you not only about Shakespeare, but so much about the time in which he lived and the anti-Catholicism that was going on at that time. And one of the things that I want to mention, and I'm, you know, trying to get a lot in here, is that Catholics today, I think all the way to this day, still retain that sort of unwillingness to evangelize outside of their own circles. One, because the Catholic faith is more complex than a Protestant, and there are more things to understand and convey than there is in a Protestant, so it's a little bit harder to do so. But the other is because there was a huge inward turn during the so-called Reformation, in which there was so much anti-Catholicism. We're talking about it in England, but of course it was in other countries as well. And a lot of it was used, this anti-Catholicism, by the civil authorities for their own gain. They really didn't care about the religion that much. Even Queen Elizabeth, I don't think, did. It was more or less they could use this to gain all kinds of church property, to fine Catholics, and to accuse various people of being Catholic or starting religious wars and so forth, in which they actually had their own civilian goals that they wanted to accomplish by going to war with or fighting other people or taking over property and that kind of thing. And it's come down to us today that somehow there were all these religious wars, but if you really examine them, most of them were not. They were really over civil things, and a lot of this, religion was used simply as an excuse, to demonize people or to demonize the other side. A lot of that stuff is going on in a secular way today. And really, there's no such thing as secularism when we say it, because everybody believes in something, and all beliefs, all principles at bottom are religious principles. I've said this so many times. So when you have people today that say they don't believe in anything or they're pure materialists, that itself has become a form of religion. So this is what was going on. But at any rate, Shakespeare's father was considered and suspected by the authorities of being Catholic. There's all kinds of evidence to that fact. And Stratford itself was a town in which there were probably many, many Catholics, and there was a resistance there. It says it is also very likely, considering the population, Stratford was only around 1,500, that Shakespeare's father would have known Robert Dibdale, and Shakespeare himself would have known, a martyred priest who has since been beatified by the Catholic Church. Dibdale was born around 1558 at Shottery, a village less than 2 miles to the west of Stratford. As such, it is likely not only that John Shakespeare knew the future martyr, who would be hanged, drawn, and quartered at Tyburn in London in 1586, aged about 28, but that his son William knew him too, being only 6 years younger than Dibdale, and being 11 years old when Dibdale left Stratford to pursue his vocation to the priesthood on the continent. Nor, as we shall see, was Dibdale the only Catholic martyr with whom England's greatest writer seems to have been acquainted. And there was a lot of irreverence toward the Queen and toward the new religion in Stratford. An example of such irreverence was given most memorably by the Shakespeare's friend and neighbor Elizabeth Wheeler when she told the Puritans on the church court in 1592 exactly what she thought of them and their newfangled religion. She said, "God's wounds," that was an expression, it's swoons is what it later became. You see it spelled in Shakespeare sometimes, Z-O-U-N-D-S, and people say zounds, but it means swoons, meaning wounds, and it was just an expression. And she says, "God's wounds, a fart of one's arse for you," and you can well know what that means. In fact, she's saying a fart out of one's behind for you is what she's saying to these Protestant Puritans who are trying to bully the town. And so Shakespeare grew up in a town and with a family that were sort of outlaws, and his father, his mother's side of the family, the Ardens, were strongly Catholic and pro-Catholic. And one of the Ardens, Edward Arden, I think it was horribly tortured and killed for being a Catholic. Edward Arden was grisly martyred, and it's here on page 85. Let me get to that. I want to make sure I get that in. Here's what was done to you if you were a Catholic in many cases. It said Edward Arden, that was, Shakespeare's mother's family, was executed on December 20th at Smithfield Market in London, being hanged, cut down while still alive, then disemboweled, beheaded, and quartered. His head was placed on a spike at London Bridge as a warning against other papist traitors. Lest we should forget the full, grim, and grueling reality of the fate suffered by so-called papist traitors, let's quote the historian Wood on the details of Arden's execution. And he says here, Arden was dragged on a hurdle, and I'm not sure what that exactly is, but it's some kind of device in which he was strapped to and carried, behind horses from Newgate through the waking city to the place of execution at Smithfield. Capital punishment in the Elizabethan state was a long, drawn-out, savage, humiliating, and very public affair. When sentenced, you were told by the judge to prepare to be hanged by the neck. And this is a quote from one of the sentences of that time, to be, quote, hanged by the neck and being alive, cut down, and your privy members to be cut off, and your bowels to be taken out of your belly, and they're burned while you are still alive. So in other words, your private parts are cut off while you're alive. You're hanged until you choke and choke and choke, and then finally you're lowered down, you're still alive, and then your privy parts are cut off. Then you are disemboweled, your intestines are pulled out, and they're set on fire right before your own eyes. Then your heart finally would be cut out, mercifully, I guess, and displayed to the crowd before your body was carved up with a butcher's knife. To send a message to the people, this theater of cruelty took place on a public stage, often in a market or meeting place, such as Tyburn, Smithfield, Cheapside, or St. Giles. This is what Shakespeare witnessed in his years growing up, from the time he was probably 11 years old through 16 or 17 or so. I mean, he saw some of these go on, and he was from a family that it could happen to, so you can understand the way he behaved. The lost years, Shakespeare left his wife and children. And, of course, some scholars said, well, he deserted his wife and children because he went to London, and then he make up all kinds of stories about how, you know, he, the lights of London and the life in the theater and so forth attracted him. He did everything from, you know, being unfaithful to practicing homosexuality and this. There is no evidence to show any of this. This is wishful thinking on the part of critics. Did he desert his wife and children on the mere whim? Let's look at the evidence of history. That he was forced to leave Stratford due to persecution by Sir Thomas Lucy, the local magistrate and anti-Catholic zealot, who was appointed by Elizabeth's government to investigate the Somerville plot. This was a plot supposedly by a person known to Shakespeare by the name of Somerville, who was supposedly, he denied it, he was supposedly threatened to kill the queen. And there were all kinds of plots constantly being brought to light. Most of them were fake. There were a few that were real, like the gunpowder plot, you know, headed up by Guy Hawkes, which you probably heard of, and if not, you can read about it. But most of these plots were just rumors and fantasies in somebody's mind, or somebody was simply grumbling and complaining about the oppression and so forth of the Elizabethan authorities, and all kinds of stuff was made up, and people were burned and hanged and killed and tortured ripped with ripping knives, and there were actually instruments that were made of a number of knife blades that they ripped you with, you know, and not to kill you, but to rip you up on both sides, you know, as a means of punishment. The tradition states that the young Shakespeare had to escape Lucy's wrath after he was caught poaching in Lucy's deer park a few miles outside of Stratford. Well, for one thing, Lucy didn't have a deer park, so Shakespeare probably wasn't poaching there. But this was the accusation made against him, because Lucy didn't like him and suspected him of being a Catholic. So probably, and we don't know for sure, but with things like this happening, Shakespeare left. In order to prove their argument that the motive for Percy's persecution of Shakespeare was his religious convictions, some Shakespeare scholars, you know, that believed Shakespeare was Catholic, point out that there are other reasons given in the movement against Shakespeare at that time. And so it wasn't just the idea of poaching. And later on, Shakespeare, you know, became sort of a local hero, and when everything became more Protestant, his poaching on Lucy's property was sort of turned into a Robin Hood-like thing. People remade him into a Protestant, and therefore his poaching had to be, this charges against him had to be re-explained as Shakespeare doing good things, you know, maybe taking animals and so forth from Lucy's property in order to help the poor, sort of like a Robin Hood, you know, so they could recast Shakespeare as a Protestant hero and, you know, the hero of their town. And a lot of that contributed to scholars later on looking upon Shakespeare as a Protestant and then denying all the evidence that was coming forth and is coming forth today. They denied it for a long time because there was far more anti-Catholicism earlier, and scholars today are more interested in trying to get at the real facts of what actually happened and what was going on. And so it says, but what of the poaching theory? Isn't it likely to be a romanticized memory of the local hero, casting him into the role of a latter-day Robin Hood, stealing from the rich to give to the poor? By the late 17th century, the Catholic resistance had been largely broken and had collapsed, and most people, even in resolutely Catholic Stratford, had conformed to the new religion or lapsed into agnosticism. As memories faded and as the years passed, the reason for Lucy's persecution of Shakespeare had become blurred. The folk tales about Stratford's most celebrated son transformed him into a folk hero, a dashing and daring young man who poached from the hated Lucy. And such a theory fits with the related fact that England, by the end of the 17th century, had become culturally anti-Catholic to such a degree that memories of Shakespeare's Catholicism would not have been the topic of polite conversation. The real Shakespeare was already beginning to make way in the public psyche for the chimera of the idealized and idolized Englishman, a figurehead for the nation itself. Shakespeare was becoming what the people wanted him to be. The man was being replaced by the myth. And so, you know, this is what happens. In other words, once the resistance was crushed, once Anglicanism became the order of the day, and once the prejudice against Catholicism became also widespread and orderly, and once most Catholics had been turned into Protestants and there was only the few underground Catholics left, you had all of these stories being rechanged into people that the, like Shakespeare, becoming heroes, but they certainly couldn't be Catholic heroes, so they had to be transformed and recast into something else. And that's been going on with Shakespeare's life from that time all the way until this day. Shakespeare is being recast into not only what Protestants want, but what the secular world wants him to be, and what all of the crazy, you know, fads and movements of our modern times are trying to cast him into. But at any rate, there is a beguiling piece of evidence from Shakespeare's own writing that throws some much-needed light on his relationship with his wife. You know, it's been said that Shakespeare was estranged from his wife. Well, he was, in the sense that he was gone a lot, but he came back later on in his, you know, his later life and lived in Stratford for the rest of his life. You know, it was not a long time after that, but he came back and lived for the rest of his life there. He was always coming back to Stratford. He always provided well for his wife and for his children. So this poem by Shakespeare, it is clear that the reference to Anne Hathaway in Sonnet 145, that's his wife Anne Hathaway, which constitutes a light so illuminating that the sonnet warrants quoting in full. And I'll read it. It's a pun in here, but it's also something that you need to see with your eyes. But it says here, those lips that love's own hand did make breathe forth the sound that said I hate to me, that languished for her sake. So he's saying, my wife's lips are saying I hate, and he, you know, to me that languished for her sake. But when she saw my woeful state, straight in her heart did mercy come, chiding that tongue that, ever sweet, was used in giving gentle doom, and taught it thus anew to greet. I hate, she altered with an end that followed it as gentle day doth follow night, who like a friend from heaven to hell is flown away. I hate, from hate away she threw, and saved my life, saying, not you. In other words, this is the poem doesn't name his wife. And it says that this woman says, I hate, and she says it to him, the poet, Shakespeare. But then she changed it to not I just hate, she changed it to I hate not thee. And look at the last line. I hate, from hate away, she threw. Hate away is a pun on half away. And then at the end, and save my life, saying, not you. I hate not you. But look at that. And is a pun for and save my life, saying, not you. And the fact is when Lucy was persecuting Shakespeare, Shakespeare's house was searched while he was gone. And there were accusations against Shakespeare. I can't get into all of what went on. But the fact is his wife was there, and she had to bear these inspections and accusations. And Shakespeare may be saying here, and save my life by saying not you, meaning that his wife saved his life by diverting these people away from himself. And it might be later on that there was this estrangement, and maybe in a fit she tried to say, I hate you for all the stuff you have caused with this, double life. But she changed it in mid-sentence to say not you. I hate not you. So we're going to end here with that, with his wife saying that to him in that sonnet. And he was so good at punning and making the puns very, very deep. Sometimes he goes on 5 or 6 levels if you look at his puns. He's talking about religious things as well as secular things as well as a personal thing and so on. And you have to quite get into it to understand it. But we're going to end here. That Shakespeare had a really interesting and very dangerous life. It's a great book to read. I hope you do read it. I hope you enjoyed this, and we'll go on with Joseph Pierce's book on literature and get into some of the other literary giants in that book next week. So be sure to tune in then. In the meantime, St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do, O Prince of the Heavenly Hosts, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for their souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com. Or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.